Okay, welcome to this special class on the events of Purim, Tovshin Yud Gimel. That's Purim 1953. And just to give you a bit of background, how this class came about, why we're here, my name is Rabbi Chase Taub, and we've been studying a maimer, a Hasidic discourse from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, called Al Kein Koru, which is about the lottery that Haman used or attempted to use as an instrument of destruction of the Jewish people, God forbid. And it goes into all types of deep explanation about seeming randomness, divine choice, Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people, what that's based on. And it's very, very deep stuff. We just finished studying that. If you would like to study the actual text, first of all, you're welcome to study the text on your own. But if you would like to study with me, there are recordings. And I think it took us five classes to get through the discourse, which I think is of nine chapters. And you could watch that or listen to that, or probably wherever you're watching or listening right now. But it could be on our website, soulwords.org, or on YouTube, youtube.com/soulwords, or on podcast platforms like Spotify or Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts, or on Torah Anytime. You may be watching right now. Okay, at any rate, so if you would like to study the actual mimer, the actual discourse, there's where you can do it. But this class came about because I'd mentioned that at the Fabrengen, at the gathering where the Rebbe said that mimer, there was this strange sort of occurrence which was understood to be connected to the mysterious sudden death of the Haman of that time, of 1953, Stalin, Yimach Shemai, Vizichrei. So that's what this class is about. It's about what happened at the Rebbe's Fabrengen, Tovshin Yud Gimel, 1953, and its connection to the death of Stalin. Before we begin our learning for tonight, I want to dedicate tonight's class to the memory of Yosef Malachi ben Yitzchak David, Hashem Yikem Domei. He was a first responder on October 7th, and this class has been sponsored, and the research going into this class has been sponsored in his merit. May it serve as an aliyas and neshama for him. May his family be comforted, and may all Klal Yisrael be comforted, and we should never know such pain ever again. Okay, so I'm going to very, very briefly tell you about the events of that Fabrengen, but then we will come back to it. We'll circle back, and we have a timeline which we're going to follow, which will really break it down as far as what happened and when it happened, what days, and even down to the hours, the exact time, like the time in New York, the time in Moscow, what was really going on. And we'll get to that in more particular as we go on tonight in the evening. But just to start with, especially because there may be people joining us who are not familiar at all with this story, I want to briefly tell the story in its generality. Okay. The general story is like this. At 9 p.m., the Rebbe's Fabrengen began. We're talking about, we'll go into the timeline later. We'll revisit this and break it down. But just very, very quickly and briefly, this was Sunday night. Purim was a Matzah Shabbos. Purim started coming out of Shabbos, just like in this year, the Kviyos of this year, if you're watching this year. And then the Fabrengen was the night coming out of Purim. So the Fabrengen started around 9 p.m. Toward the beginning of the Fabrengen, there was a mimer. That was not uncommon at all in those days, that the mimer, which I guess you could call the highlight of the Fabrengen, the mimer would be toward the beginning of the Fabrengen. And that was the case here, and the mimer was Vayi Oimen Es Hadassah, which is a verse from the Megillah, which talks about Mordechai raised Hadassah. And that was the mimer. And when I say that was the mimer, what I mean is every Fabrengen had a mimer. Then what happened is toward the end of the Verbrengen, in the wee hours of the morning, around 4 a.m, the Rebbe suddenly became very serious with the look that he would have before he would say a mimer, which didn't make any sense because the Rebbe had already said the mimer. And what ended up happening is the Rebbe said a second mimer, Al Kein Koru, this mimer that I was mentioning earlier that we just finished studying together. And it was the first time the Rebbe had ever said a second mimer at a Verbrengen. Now, before the Rebbe said the mimer, and by the way, there was no Nigun Hachono. Normally, before a mimer, there's a preparatory melody to get everyone ready for it. This was out of the blue. So, before the mimer, the Rebbe told a story, and the story seemingly had nothing to do with anything that had been discussed at that point. It's an odd story, and it's kind of a humorous story. The story is that after the revolution in Russia, so they did away with the Tsar, and now there were rights for everybody, including the Jews, and people could vote. I mean, we know obviously how oppressive communism was, but officially now all of a sudden everyone had rights, they could vote, and so there were elections. And the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Chabad Rebbe, who was the Rebbe at the time, right after the revolution, said that the Chassidim should vote. Okay, so there was a Chassid who was totally oblivious to not only to politics, but to anything worldly. So he didn't know who was running or what their policies were or anything like that. He just knew that the Rebbe said to vote, so you go vote. And he did it as like a shlichus, as like a something that the Rebbe told him to do. He was on a mission from the Rebbe, and he went in, he put on a gartel, and he did it like it was a whole holy thing. And he comes out, and there was a political rally going on. It's interesting because in America, I think there are laws about how close to a polling place you can have, I think, what do they call it, canvassing? How close to a political place you can have any type of campaigning. At any rate, he comes out of the polling place, and there's a political rally going on, and they're talking politics. He can't understand Russian. This is how like out of it this guy was. Not only he didn't follow politics, he spoke Yiddish, and he didn't speak Russian. You know, he lived in the shtetl, and he interacted with Jews all day. He didn't speak Russian. So he doesn't know what they're talking about. But then they start cheering, hoorah, which is like hooray, you know, hoorah. So they're cheering, hoorah. And he doesn't know what that means. He thinks they're saying in Hebrew, hoorah. In Hebrew, hoorah is two words. He is evil. Hoorah. He is evil. So he thinks whoever they're cursing, you know, this is a bad guy. This guy's pretty rah. This guy's an evil guy. So he started singing with them, hoorah. And the Rebbe is telling this story about the chassid who's cheering hoorah, thinking that he's saying hoorah, he is evil. And the Rebbe starts saying it, hoorah. And the Rebbe says it three times, hoorah, hoorah. Now you're going to ask, what did it sound like? Well, unfortunately, we don't have a recording of that Verbrengen. We have a picture. In fact, I can show it to you right here, this picture. And this apparently was photographed at the time of the story. And you see the Rebbe's, the way he's holding his arms there. It's described when it's written up that the Rebbe held his hands or his arms in like a triangle shape. So that's that triangle shape there. And that's apparently that's the hand motion that accompanies the hoorah. Okay. So what did it sound like? Like I said, we don't have a recording, but Rabbi Yoel Kahn, Olav Shalom, who was the Rebbe's chaser, he was at the Verbrengen, and he repeated what it sounded like. So we don't have the actual sound of the Rebbe's holy voice, and that is something that cannot be approximated, and that's just a void that we don't have. And maybe someday recordings of this Verbrengen will surface. But we have Rabbi Yoel repeating his recollections. And from that, we can try to imagine what it might have sounded like. So let's just play a clip from that.
Это фердвейкет, гифе, ура! Драбат ноги маскилон, ויין נוכח את הסגטן. זה אבל לא גמחת, כי כאילו, זה די מה זה הפגשיין. מדח שאת מראה מתגוון דמיין, זה די למציא כשרים. זה איזה כשרים, אורה, דרי מו. כשרים אורה. היה נגדי מייסה. נמצא, אמנו איתו, על כן קורא לימין לפורים. ומה מה אמר?
Okay, so everybody hears the Rebbe saying "hura" as part of a story, but then they understand that they're supposed to join in and also say "hura," and they didn't know why they're doing it. They just got the impression that this is what's supposed to be happening, so they start saying "hura" with understanding that double meaning that "hura" in Hebrew means he is evil, and then. After that story, the Rebbe goes straight into the Maimra. Al kein karu, like out of the blue. Like I told you, with no preparatory song or anything. And the Rebbe said this Maimra, the second Maimra of the evening. First time the Rebbe ever said a second Maimra. Okay. Everyone knew that something happened. It was not the typical type of thing. There was something strange. There was something inexplicable. But nobody knew what. A few days later, news comes out of the blue, Stalin fell. He can't speak. He's unresponsive. And then, a little bit after that, Stalin's dead. So immediately, I'll call it a fan theory developed among Chassidim. Oh, that's what it was. And the Rebbe was saying at the Fabrengen, hoorah! And everybody joined in, hoorah! That there was something happening at the Fabrengen, hoorah! Talking about Stalin, Yimach Shemei, hoorah! He's the evil one. And that this is connected to the death of Stalin. So in other words, the Rebbe's Fabrengen was the striking blow that brought down Stalin. Okay. Now, nobody knew really exactly the timeline. You know, the Soviets were notorious for not letting out information and specifically to let out misinformation. But there was this understanding there had to be a connection. Okay. Now, before I tell you about when this fan theory was finally established and substantiated and authenticated as being more than just fan theory. I want to just, if you're uninitiated and this sounds to you like, well, why would they think that? I mean, it's an interesting coincidence, but what? Okay, so you should know that it's not far-fetched at all. Anyone who's familiar with what is a Rebbe and a Rebbe's Fabrengen, that there's something holy, there's something spiritual that's going on that we are not privy to. It's happening on another plane, and we don't see the whole picture. So I want to just tell you quickly a story that it may or may not be connected, but it's just to give you flavor so you can understand why people would draw this type of a connection, that something at the Rebbe's Fabrengen in Brooklyn is causing the death of Stalin in Moscow. Okay. There's a story about the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Rebbe of Chabad, the Balatanya's grandson, who he raised. There was a ribbon-cutting ceremony. I almost said groundbreaking, but because I'm thinking about when there was the groundbreaking for the expansion of 770. And there wasn't yet the ribbon cutting, although maybe Amir Tzashem. I shouldn't say maybe. Amir Tzashem, there will be a ribbon cutting. But there was a ribbon cutting ceremony at the new expanded shul in Lubavitch. Why? There was a fire that destroyed the main synagogue. So they built on, they rebuilt, and then they had the ribbon cutting ceremony. That's when they, you know, when they rededicate or they open up the new building. And so at the event, and this is in 1857, and this is in the actual town of Lubavitch. So at this ribbon cutting ceremony, the Tzemach Tzedek asked the Chassidim, do you want to hear a mimer or do you want to hear a story? Interesting that he gave them the choice. They said, we want to hear a story. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, okay, I'll tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a Jew named Rabbi Yankiv who was a property manager. Jews couldn't own property, but what he would do is he would rent property from the Paritz, from the non-Jewish nobleman, and then he would manage that property by subletting it to other Jews. And I guess he had like commercial property, and he rented out one of these properties to another Jew who would run it as a what we call a kretschma. It's a famous thing that Jews often were, they were innkeepers. And I have a great grandfather whose last name was Schenker. What's a Schenker? Schenker is a bartender. Okay, a lot of Jews would be like the managers of bars, taverns, inns, whatever you want to call it. You know, it was like a hotel slash restaurant. At any rate, so this Schenker, this Baal Kretschma, did not do very good business, and he had no money, and he couldn't pay rent. The problem is that the Jew, Rabbi Yankiv, who he was renting from, whether or not he collected rent, he had to turn around and pay rent to the Poritz. So he was out money every month when he would have to make the rent payments. So eventually he tells this tenant of his, you got to go. I can't be paying for your losses because I got to pay rent even if you don't pay me. So I got to get a tenant who's going to pay me. So you got to go. So the tenant ran to the Ruzhiner, Rabbi Yisrael Ruzhiner, the Halakha Ruzhiner, and told him this story. And this Rabbi Yankiv was a chosid of the Ruzhiner. So he listened to what he told him. The Ruzhiner told him, forgive the loan and negotiate lower terms where it's cheaper, you know, cheaper rent that he'll be able to make the payments. And that's what happened. And what happened after that is he still couldn't make payments, even at the lower rate. So a second time he told him, you gotta go. I'm sorry, I gotta get a tenant who can pay. And the tenant ran to the Ruzhiner again and told him the story. And the Ruzhiner told him, go back and tell the guy, I say, forgive the loan and go even lower, pay even a lower rent. So he had no choice, or he felt he had no choice. He lowered it again. He forgave the old loan and he lowered the rent. Okay. But still, the Baal Kretschma is not paying rent. So finally, Rabbi Yankiv says, I can't take it. Now it's the third time. I can't take it. You're evicted. I got to get a tenant who could pay. So the guy, again, the third time, he ran to the Ruzhiner. The Ruzhiner said the same thing. The guy came back. The Ruzhiner says, you got to forgive me. He says, I'm sorry. You know what? This much I can't do. I can't take it. No is no. And he kicked him out. Okay. So the Tzemach Tzedek is telling this story at the ribbon cutting ceremony of the new shul or the expanded shul in Lubavitch. Okay. So he says, this Rabbi Yankiv passed away. And he came to the heavenly court and they reviewed his life and they told him, the angels there who run they're in the heavenly court, they told him, look, your life looks beautiful. You did a lot of good, but there's this one like blemish that really we can't overlook. And that is the cruelty that you evicted that tenant, that Baal Kretschma, the innkeeper. So this is that I evicted him? I gave him three tries. It was only the third try where I finally, three strikes, you're out. I threw him out. So they said, I'm sorry, we can't let you in. He said, I don't accept your ruling. I don't accept your ruling because you're angels. You've never been in the physical world. You've never had bodies. You don't know about financial pressure. You don't understand what it means when you have to pay rent and the person who's supposed to pay you isn't paying you. You cannot judge me. You cannot judge me. You don't know what it's like. So the angel said, fine, you know what? No problem. We will get two neshamas, souls, who've been in the world. They're here now with us in heaven, but they've been in the world. They know what money is. So they got the Mechaber, the compiler of the Shulchan Aruch, and they got the Bach, the commentary on the Torah. So two great giants of halacha, and they judged the case. And they looked at it and they said, we're sorry. You know what? That was very cruel of you to evict the Baal Kretschma. So Rabbi Yankiv hears it. He says, you know what? I don't accept your ruling either. Because even though you were in the physical world and you knew what money was and you had to deal with money when you were embodied, but you haven't been in the physical world for so long, you forgot. You forgot. I don't accept your ruling. You guys are too out of touch with what the physical world is like. So the Tzemach Tzedek is telling this story. And he looks at the chassidim there and he says, so what do you say? What do you say? Reb Yankiv, as Gven Gerecht, he was in the right? No one understood what they were, like, the Tzemach Tzedek's asking a question, but are they supposed to answer it? So the Tzemach Tzedek answered, he said, I say he was in the right. Gerecht! Gerecht! He was right! And they all of a sudden took the cue and they understood that this case was referred to them. That Reb Yankiv complained and said, you can't judge me. You don't know what the physical world is like anymore. So then they gave it over to the Tzemach Tzedek, and the Tzemach Tzedek's asking them, what do you say? You know, you're physical beings right now. You're in the physical world. You guys all have a rent you got to make, or a mortgage, or you got to pay bills, utilities, whatever it is. You relate to Reb Yankiv. So what do you say? Gerecht, gerecht. And everyone is chanting, gerecht. Yeah, he's okay. He's right. So I tell you that story because there was... It's not far-fetched at all to say that there was always something going on at a Verbrengen that was beyond regular understanding. And that sometimes there would be a glimpse of it, and sometimes not. But the fact that something like that would happen is... Once you understand that world, it's not difficult to accept that, yeah, it really could be that the Rebbe is in Brooklyn, Verbrengen on Purim, and telling a story, hoorah, hoorah, and that is bringing down Stalin, Yamach Shmei, in Moscow. Why not? Why not? Right? Okay, fine. But like I said, that was fan theory, unsubstantiated, unauthenticated. For, well, what do we say, 1953 until 1991, which is 38 years later. Is that right? My math correct? Accountants, let me know. Okay, so 38 years later, 1991. Anyone who remembers the spring of 1991 will remember what was going on in the world at the time, the Gulf War. And it was a very tense time. And especially people were saying that terrible things, God forbid, are going to happen. And it was based on intentions that the Hum in Baghdad had very explicitly said and actually acted on and sent Scud missiles actually into populated areas in Eretz Yisrael. So it was a very tense time, a very scary time. And the Mimer Al-Kain Karu from 1953, which was connected to bringing down the Hum of that time, Stalin, from 1953, that mimer was then published in 1991 in the midst of the tension of the Gulf War, sort of as a connection to the events that were happening right then at that time when the mimer was edited and published. Okay, and that gave us the opportunity to have this fan theory substantiated. Without going into a lengthy explanation of what it means for the Rebbe to review a mimer, let me just say very, very quickly that when the Rebbe would say a mimer, so there would be a transcript, and like I mentioned, Rabbi Yoel, who was the chief chaser, responsible for creating these transcripts of the entire Verbrengen, but of the mimerim included within that. But then there's something where the Rebbe would edit the mimer, and that was a whole different level of authority. And you're going to say, well, is it that they didn't trust that those who put together the transcripts got the words right? No, because there were recordings of weekday Verbrengens. So it's not just about getting the words right. People speak differently than they write. When a mimer was edited, the Rebbe would change things, even the things that the Rebbe had said at the time, but the editing of the mimer was a whole different art form or science than putting together a transcript. So suffice it to say that an edited mimer where the Rebbe had reviewed every word and every comma and every period and every footnote and literally every detail. That's a whole new level of authority that mimer brings with it. Now, when they wrote up that mimer, what they did is, and this part is not unusual, they wrote a Pesach Daver. A Pesach Daver is a preface, and every mimer that was published had a Pesach Daver, had a preface. And it's not unusual that the preface, if there were some type of historical context of the mimer, that would be mentioned. Like if the mimer was said in conjunction with an event, such as maybe a Yahrzeit, or a birthday, or one of the days of the liberation of a Rebbe, a Hasidic Yom Tov. So that would always be mentioned. So what they did is they wrote it up, and I can pull it up here. Here's the Pesach Daver. And you see where it says, Likras Yemei HaPurim HaBa'aleinu L'Tova. We're coming up to the days of Purim. And what does it mean, coming up to the days of Purim? So you look at the very bottom, it says the date when this mimer was published. Yod Aleph Adar, Tavshin Nun Aleph. So we're talking about 3 days before Purim. So it says, in anticipation or leading up to the days of Purim, we're putting out here, we're publishing this mimer, Al Kein Karu, which the Rebbe said at the Purim Fabrengen of Tavshin Yud Gimel. And then it mentions here, HaMimer Asheni, that this is the second mimer, and then I mentioned to you that the first mimer was Vayihi Oymen Es Hadassah. So this is the second mimer, Al Kein Koru. All right, so this is the second mimer that was said at that year's Fabrengen. Now, here, let me slow down. Where it says, She'emirose Hoysa Kishura, that it's saying that the mimer is being said or delivered was connected. Kinira, apparently, that's how I'll translate Kinira, apparently, seemingly, with the events that were going on at that time, which have to do with the downfall of the ruler of that country, Medina Ahi, that Rebbe would never refer to the Soviet Union. We just call it Medina Ahi, that country. The ruler of that country who was a Tzairer Yisrael, an oppressor of the Jewish people, as it was understood at the time from the telling of the story that the Rebbe told before and in conjunction with the recitation of the mimer about a chassid of the Rebbe Rishab during the time of the revolution after the downfall of the Tsar. So at any rate, you understand the significance of this, is that the Rebbe is now not only editing the mimer, the actual words of the mimer, but the Pesach Daver as well. So this was the stamp of approval that the Rebbe is saying, yes, it's not just fan fiction, it's not just fan theory. There is a connection. It's kishura, it's connected. Kinira, apparently. And you see the wording there. It doesn't say that it caused it. It's not, it doesn't say the Rebbe killed Stalin. It says that the saying of the mimer with the preface of the story is connected apparently to the downfall of Stalin. And that the Rebbe agreed, yes, that is indeed what happened. Okay. So that is an incredible revelation, and it's an incredible gift that we have those words approved from the Rebbe, that we know that it's not just something that Chassidim theorize, that there's really something there. And it's, like I said, it's a gift that we have that. Okay. So let's now talk about what happened in more detail. Let's go into the actual timeline of events. I'm going to pull up a timeline. We'll try to follow along. So here you see Purim 5713, 1953, timeline of Stalin's demise. I'm going to break it down for you exactly what happened and when based on the information that we have today. Now, I want to comment that there is always doubt about any information that comes from the Soviets. And we know that they manipulated and they purposely misled people and kept things secret and gave misinformation. So you can take it with a grain of salt and you could choose to not completely believe the timeline. And it happens to be a subject of scholarship that many, many, many people have studied. And by this point in history, so many years later, the events have been examined by so many people that you can choose to believe or to disbelieve. I'm telling you what is understood to have been the timeline of events based on all of the people who have studied it and reconstructed it and put together what actually happened. Okay. So Purim of Tavshin Yud Gimel was a Matzah Shabbos Sunday, like this year. If you're watching this when I'm making it, this is a Tavshin Ayin Dalet. So it had the same kvias, Matzah Shabbos Sunday, meaning just like this year where Tanis Esther is on a Thursday. So Matzah Shabbos, Saturday night, let's look here. Saturday night is the night going into Purim. By the night going into Purim, what I mean is that's the night of the first Megillah reading. 8 p.m. New York time is 4 a.m. Moscow time. At approximately this time, after a night of heavy drinking, Stalin goes to bed with strict orders given not to be disturbed until he wakes up on his own. Now, you should understand that people were terrified of Stalin. It's not just that Stalin killed millions of people. It's that Stalin killed the people right next to him. Stalin was an absolute unpredictable monster. So when he said, he's going to bed, don't bother me, they were terrified to bother him. And because of that, that probably, at least from the natural perspective, led to his demise, the fact that nobody would come bother him, even though he probably needed help. Okay. Now, let's go to the day of Purim. 3 p.m. Sunday. Now it's Sunday. It's the next day. New York. This is March 1st. 3 p.m. Sunday, March 1st, New York time. This corresponds to 11 p.m. It's an 8-hour time difference. And someone asked me, well, what about daylight savings time? Well, daylight savings time in 1953 was in like late April. I looked it up. It was much after. It was much later than Purim. Okay, so 8-hour time difference. 11 p.m. Sunday in Moscow, after hearing no sounds coming from Stalin's room, the housekeeper, they probably sent the housekeeper because she's expendable, you know, let her get killed. The housekeeper finally enters to find him collapsed on the floor. Now you're thinking, hold on a second. Then he went to bed 4 a.m. Sunday morning, what we call Saturday night, but it's officially Sunday morning. They didn't go in and find him collapsed until 11 p.m. Sunday. That's how many hours? That's 19 hours he was like lying on the floor. Yeah, that's correct. That's what it was. Okay. So this is the afternoon of Purim in New York, 3 p.m. Said 3 p.m. New York is 11 p.m. Moscow. Now, I mentioned that the Rebbe's Fabrengen started at 9 p.m. So 9 p.m. New York time, Sunday night, meaning the night coming out of Purim, that's 5 a.m. Moscow time. That's when the Rebbe's Fabrengen, Purim Fabrengen, started in Brooklyn. All right. 11 p.m. that night, meaning in the middle of the Fabrengen, New York time, that's 7 a.m. Moscow time. After a delay, doctors are called to treat Stalin, who remains unresponsive. Now you're going to say, hold on a second. When did they find him? They found him 11 p.m. Moscow time on Sunday, and they're calling doctors at 7 a.m. Monday, Moscow time. That's 8 hours later. So not only did they not find him until 19 hours after he collapsed, but even after they found him collapsed, they didn't call doctors for another 8 hours? The answer is yes. That's correct. Again, they were terrified of him. They were terrified that he would wake up, he would come to, and he would see doctors, and he would be terrified. Who are these people? Why did you call them? Who called them? And he would just murder everybody. So they were terrified to do anything. They didn't call doctors till 7 a.m. So here's what I want to point out to you. At 7 a.m. Monday, they called doctors. I don't know how many doctors. I don't know who they were. What I'm saying is, though, that at that point, how many people in the world knew that Stalin had fallen? Just the very, very inner circle, the housekeeper, and the few doctors that they called. Oh, and by the way, according to some reports, they were so afraid to call doctors who they didn't know already. They had a doctor who was on staff who was a veterinarian. Treated animals. So the doctor, it fits him, that treated Stalin was actually a veterinarian, or at least one of the first doctors, first responders who dealt with him was a veterinarian, was an animal doctor. Okay. Well, my point is, I want to bring out, how many people in the world knew about Stalin's condition at that time? A handful of people. I'm pointing this out because, I'll say it like this. I never looked into the timeline of Stalin's death and the Purim Verbrennen. But, you know, I had always kind of assumed that the Rebbe said the Mimer and Stalin was like walking down the street, totally normal, and then he collapsed. I don't know. Why did I assume it like that? I don't know, because that's just the way that I assumed. Looking into it, and again, you may be skeptical about any sources that come out of the Soviet Union, but looking into it, it appears that Stalin had already fallen ill long before the Verbrennen. Now, it was Purim. It was on Purim. Remember, he went to bed 4 a.m. Moscow time, which was 8 p.m. New York time, the night going into Purim. So it was the day of Purim when Stalin fell ill, but it was long before the Verbrennen. By the time the Rebbe's Verbrennen started, Stalin was already collapsed. He had been collapsed for a long time. Okay. But here's what I want to show you. All right. So at this point, how many people in the entire world know Stalin's situation? And I'll show you in the timeline later, they did not release any news of this for days. That he was even sick, they did not release news for days. Because, as you know, they were extremely tight-lipped and in control of the narrative at all times. Okay, so only a few people in the world knew at this time that the doctors had been called in. And that was in the middle of the Rebbe's Purim Verbrennen, 11 p.m. New York, 7 a.m. Moscow. Okay, so here's what I want to show you. 4 a.m., Monday, March 2nd. The Rebbe said the story, hoorah, you know, the story about the chassid of the Rebbe Rashab voting, and the Rebbe said the Maimer, Al Kin Karu. That's midday, 12 p.m. noon in Moscow. The news that Stalin had even fallen ill is not released until how long after? 3 days after Purim, 12 a.m., midnight, Wednesday, March 4th in New York, 8 a.m., 8 in the morning, Wednesday, March 4th, Moscow. Soviet news announces that Stalin is unconscious. News reaches President Eisenhower's staff within the hour. Okay, now you're going to say, first of all, hold on. Soviet news reported it, and it took an hour to reach the President of the United States? Yeah, I want to explain something. It wasn't like it is now, or once something's on the news, it's on the internet, and anyone in the whole world can see it anywhere. The Soviets were extremely controlling with all information. So they let out this news domestically. That meant only people in the Soviet Union could know this information. This information didn't leak out the way that it does today. It would have to be some type of military intelligence, espionage, to get that information. So that's why it took an hour for Eisenhower to know. So here's what I want to point out. Eisenhower found that Stalin was sick. Not even that he died. In fact, apparently he hadn't died yet at this point. Eisenhower only knows that Stalin is sick on Wednesday morning, or Wednesday in the middle of the night. And in Washington, D.C., it would be like Wednesday at like 1 a.m. was when the staff found out. Okay. So, and by the way, at this time, Eisenhower had just been sworn in. He was a new president. So he had only been president for like 6 weeks at this point, if I'm doing the math correctly. It was like the first big event of his presidency was Stalin's death. My point I'm trying to make is like this. How did the Rebbe know? What did the Rebbe know? I have no idea. I can't answer it, I can't even pretend to begin to think about such things. But here's what I will tell you. If the Rebbe knew because of Ruach HaKodesh, some type of prophecy-like knowledge, that's fine. That wouldn't surprise me. We have many stories that make it pretty clear that the Rebbe knew things that cannot be known other than some type of supernatural, miraculous type way of knowing things. So if that's how the Rebbe knew, that's how the Rebbe knew. But if the Rebbe knew by what we call Bedas Tachtein, that there was a way of explaining it according to natural means, then to me it's even cooler. To me, this is just personal preference. But if the Rebbe knew because of actual inside information, to me that's, in a way, even cooler than knowing by Ruach HaKodesh, because here's the deal. If the Rebbe knew at 4 in the morning, New York time, Sunday, in the wee hours of Sunday morning, 4 a.m., when the Rebbe said the Hurrah story, and Eisenhower finds out Wednesday, or Eisenhower's staff, that actually they didn't even tell him until later, but Eisenhower's inner staff finds out Wednesday around a little bit after midnight, around like 1 a.m. So the Rebbe knew days before Eisenhower, which means that if the Rebbe knew from a leak, then the Rebbe had better intelligence, I'm talking about military intelligence, than the President of the United States. So either way you want to look at it. If it was Ruach HaKodesh, it was Ruach HaKodesh. Of course, what's surprising, the Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. But if the Rebbe knew because there was a leak and somebody somehow got the information to the Rebbe at the Fabrengen that this was going on, then the Rebbe had information that was days faster than the information that the President of the United States himself had. So to me, that's even, it's even cooler. Either way you look at it. Okay. Then finally, 4 days after Purim, Thursday, 2 p.m. New York time, 10 p.m. Moscow time, doctors pronounce Stalin dead. When he actually died, I don't know. That's when the doctors pronounced him dead. But they still didn't reveal it. No, of course not. They held everything very, very close to the vest. So they finally announced it. The Soviets announced it. Pravda. 5 days after Purim, 8 p.m. Thursday, March 5th, New York time. 4 a.m. Friday, March 6th, Moscow time. Soviet news announces Stalin's death domestically while preventing foreign correspondents from reporting abroad for several more hours. Remember, I told you, they could control the information should not go out. So there were foreign reporters, but they were all being supervised. They were controlled. They could not let this information out. And what are they going to do? They're going to text somebody? There was no texting. You got to remember, the only way to call people then, communicate, you'd have to pick up a phone and have an operator place a call, and everything is listened to. It's not like they could get information out. So it wasn't for hours after. We're talking about Friday, Moscow time, 4 a.m., they officially let the people know in Russia, but they didn't know outside of Russia for hours. However, the United States military was listening in on the Russians, and they were able to pick up Morse code, military Morse code. And it's actually an interesting thing. For those who will understand this reference, great. For those who don't understand the reference, don't worry about it. But apparently the first American to intercept the encoded Soviet messages that Stalin was dead was Air Force Staff Sergeant John R. Cash, who you may also know as Johnny Cash, the Man in Black, a famous American musician. And when I got interested, because I saw Johnny Cash was the first American to decode the message that Stalin was dead. So I looked into it a little more. I found out, you know, Johnny Cash, when he got married, his wife insisted that on their honeymoon, they go to Eretz Yisrael. They went to Israel. And I saw an article saying that there was a movie made about his life and they left that out. Would have been nice. They could have included that. Could have inspired people. But at any rate, Johnny Cash was the first American to find out that Stalin died. So there's your trivia question. Who was the first American to find out that Stalin died? Johnny Cash. Although, by Chassidim, you might ask the question a little bit differently, which is, Kinira, who was the first American citizen, that was an American citizen, to know? Well, apparently, Kinira, apparently, that Rebbe knew days before the U.S. military or any other intelligence agency that Rebbe knew had his ways of knowing, whatever those ways may have been. Okay. So that's the timeline. And I hope that that clarifies for people what happened. And I hope it doesn't take away at all from people's understanding of the greatness of this clearly supernatural event. Like I told you, I had thought that maybe Stalin was perfectly well, and all of a sudden at the middle, you know, whatever time it would be in Moscow, I guess 4 a.m. when the Rebbe told the story, it would have been, you know, noon, that he just, you know, collapsed at his dinner table or something, or I guess it would be his lunch table. But the point is like this. Even if Stalin was already ill at that point, and that the Fabrengen was the makeh bepatish, so to speak. It was like the final hammer blow. It's still an amazing and wondrous story. And how much can we really understand about these types of things anyway? How do these things work? We don't know. But what we do know is that the Rebbe agreed and gave his holy approbation to the description of events as being connected, apparently, one to the other. Now, I should also tell you that at the time of Purim Tavshin Yud Gimel, 1953, thank God we will never know what would have happened. But it is possible, and this is not just the opinion of Chassidim, this is the opinion of those who study the history of that era, that there was about to be a mass deportation of the entire Jewish population of the Soviet Union to camps that were built during that period of time. We know that there were camps that were built, that were ordered to be built in the winter of 1953. And we know that there was an event called the Doctor's Plot. The Doctor's Plot, very, very briefly, was that the Soviets claimed to have discovered a conspiracy of Jewish doctors who were high-ranking individuals close to the party and would have had access to cause all types of damage. And these Jewish doctors were enemies of the people, and they were going to do terrible things. And it was suggested that it was like sort of like bioterrorism type stuff. And it wasn't just, I mean, unfortunately, you know, Stalin had many people arrested and unjustly convicted and sent into exile and executed. But it was more than that. It wasn't just these doctors. Apparently what was planned, and this is what historians of the era corroborate, was that the doctor's plot was supposed to be the beginning of a public campaign that the government was going to use to vilify the Jewish people in the eyes of the people and to cause pogroms against the Jewish people, which would eventually foment into widespread public condemnation of the Jewish people, which is, you know, the ironic way that it often works so often in history, is that when the Jews are singled out for oppression and brutality, so instead of people crying out and in against that injustice, they actually cry out for more injustice against the Jewish people. And that was basically the plan. And then the entire Jewry of the Soviet Union, talking about millions of Jews, would then be deported to these camps that had been built. So we don't know what would have happened, but we know what did happen, and that is when Stalin died, the doctor's plot and all of the associated campaigns of misinformation that were supposed to follow in that wake, that all fizzled. And they moved on. I guess the country was sort of reeling from the loss of Stalin. They were destabilized. So that whole thing fell apart, and then they just picked a scapegoat. Oh, you said the doctor's plot? Oh, that was a bad idea. And then they picked somebody to kill for coming up with the doctor's plot, and it fell apart. So what am I saying? I'm saying, why did it happen then? Why at that point? I don't know. I can't begin to pretend I understand these things. But what I can tell you is that from context of what we understand historically, that the time when Stalin died was a time that if he had not died, we know what the plan was. That's how I'll say it. Just like with Humann, we know what the plan was. We know what Humann wanted to accomplish, and he didn't get to. He didn't get to accomplish it. Okay? So take that as you will for whatever it's worth. Now, since we're talking about this theme, I want to share with you another story, and you can decide whether or not it is worthy of being included, but I just feel like the story is geschmack. It's an enjoyable story, and I think it fits the theme, so I'll tell you now. Shabbos HaGodol, that's the Shabbos before Pesach. Tovshin Lamed Hay, spring of 1975, was on Yud Nissen, the 10th day of the month of Nissan, which incidentally is the same kvias as the original Shabbos HaGodol. The original Shabbos HaGodol was the last Shabbos in Mitzrayim before the 10th plague. And what happened is there was a civil war that the firstborn Egyptian said, hey, Moshe Rabbeinu already warned you guys that the 10th plague is we're going to die. We're not going to stand for that. Let the Jews go or we're going to rebel against you. And what happened is there was a civil war where the elite of Egypt lashed out against their own leadership. That's what happened. And that's the concept which we refer to as Lemaki Mitzrayim Bivecharehem, that Hashem struck Egypt, you could read it, Bivecharehem, in their firstborn, meaning he struck them by what he did to the firstborn, or you could say Bivecharehem, through the means of their firstborn, meaning Hashem engineered that even before the 10th plague, there was this civil war where the firstborn Egyptians struck out against their leadership. So at the Shabbos HaGodol Fabrengen of Tovshin Lamed Hei, the Rebbe spoke about this idea about how Shabbos HaGadol is this idea of the high-ranking, prestigious elite of a country lashing out against its own leadership for the sake of the Jews, even if that's not their intention. And then the Rebbe mentioned a pasuk in Megillas Esther, a verse from Esther, V'hayamim ho'ela niskarim v'nasim. And those days, niskarim v'nasim, will be remembered or commemorated and done and celebrated, observed. And the Rebbe said, we know that the Arizal says that the way to read it is like this, niskarim, that when they're remembered, when you remember the days of old, nasim, they are done, meaning it happens now. It happens now. The Arizal explains that verse in the Megillah means that when you read about the events of days of old, it's not just history, but it's niskarim, it's remembered, but it's nasim, it's being done right now. So the Rebbe said, this is the same thing that Makis Bechiris, or rather before even the death of the firstborn, but the civil war that the firstborn waged against their own leaders on Shabbos HaGadol in 2448, the year of the Exodus, this is happening now. It's happening right now in 1975. Okay. So after the Yom Kippur War, which was Yom Kippur Tuf Shin Lamed Dalet, meaning the last few months of 1973, the king of Saudi Arabia, King Faisal, started an oil embargo, which made oil prices go sky high all over the world. And his stated purpose of the oil embargo was to punish Israel and anyone who supports Israel. So those of you listening in 2024, this is not a new thing. Okay. So, and King Faisal was one of the leaders of anti-Israel rhetoric all over the world. In fact, he was part of, he lent his forces to the Yom Kippur War. He supported the Yom Kippur War. And then after they lost the Yom Kippur War, he started trying to strike out economically with the oil embargo. Okay. So this was a time of turmoil in the world. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the strangest thing happened, that on March 25th, 1975, which is Yud Gimel Nissen, King Faisal was killed. Who killed him? His nephew killed him. He was at his, they call it the Majlis. I think I'm pronouncing it right. When I was in Dubai, they told me about the Majlis. That's like it's an Arab cultural thing that if you want to see someone and meet with them, they have like hours where they entertain people and they serve fruits and refreshments. And it's like that's when you hold court. You sit at the table and people come for the Majlis. So at any rate, and if I'm butchering the pronunciation, you'll forgive me. But at any rate, it's like a thing. So King Faisal was at his Majlis, and there was a group of visitors, I believe from Kuwait, is what I think. And his nephew was sitting in the reception area, and he went in. I think he went with the other dignitaries, and he pulled out a gun and he shot his uncle, the king of Saudi Arabia, point blank in the head and killed him. This is a very strange thing. And in fact, it was so strange that the official narrative was that Faisal's nephew was insane. That was the official explanation of it, that he was insane. So after this happened, the Rebbe's secretary, Rabbi Groner, label Groner, Olav Shalom, was able to speak to the Rebbe about the event. And actually he writes about it in his diaries, which have been published since his passing. So He says he went into the Rebbe's room, and the Rebbe asked him, "Did something happen? Like, was there news?" And he said, "Yeah, Faisal, the king of Saudi Arabia, just got killed." The Rebbe said, when? When did it happen? And Rabbi Groner told him, he said, how? How did it happen? He said, it was his nephew. The Rebbe said, why? Why did he do it? What's the reason? So Rabbi Groner said, they say he was insane. They say no reason. They just say he was insane. So then the Rebbe said, and there were people that said that the splitting of the sea when the Jews left Egypt was just a wind. It was just a natural thing. It wasn't a miracle. People said that about that too. And Rabbi Groner said, understanding that the Rebbe was sort of commenting like, yeah, people have their narrative to explain it away conveniently, but don't they see that there's something bigger here? So Rabbi Groner took the liberty to say, this is what the Rebbe was speaking about at the Shabbos Fabrengen of Makim Mitzrayim Bivecharehem. And the Rebbe said to him, ah, I'm glad that you're not one of those people who don't believe in miracles. Meaning to substantiate that, yes, that the murder of Faisal by his own nephew, remember the whole concept of the civil war of the firstborn was these were the best and the brightest of Egypt lashing out against the leadership of Egypt. So that this was a Maka Mitzrayim Bivechareyem in our time, in our day and age. Anyways, you could relate that story to the Hura story, or you could do anything else you want with it, but you have a nice story about the Rebbe now. We are obviously in interesting times right now, so I want to close with a prayer that there should be miracles for us and our time, and that all those who are the Hamans of our day should meet the same fate as Haman. And I will suggest humbly that if we want to help facilitate that, maybe I'll close with a story. I mentioned the Halakha Rishona earlier, the story about Reb Yankiv and the Baal Kretschmer, and Reb Yankiv was a chassid of the Rishona. So I'll tell you a story about the Rishona. One time there was a drought, and the chassidim came to the Rishona and they said, the crops are dying, we need rain. So he was walking with them in the forest, and he took them to a certain tree. And he pointed to the tree, and he said, when the Baal Shem Tov needed it to rain, he would go to this tree, and he would sing a certain nigun, and he would teach a certain teaching, and then it would rain. Then the Rishona continued and said, when his student and successor, my grandfather, the Maggid, needed it to rain, he would come to this tree. And he said, I can sing the song, but I don't know the teaching. And he would sing the song, and it would rain. The Rishona said, I don't know the song or the teaching, but in the merit of the story, of just telling the story of what the Baal Shem Tov and the Maggid did, let it rain. And it rained. So I'll say like this. In the merit of our telling the story, whatever needs to happen for the Jewish people should happen. And we should see it well before Purim. We should see gladness and light and joy and all of the things that we read about in the Megillah. And it shouldn't be something that we have to guess about. It should be openly obvious. It shouldn't be kinira. It should be obvious. Everyone in the whole world should be able to say how obviously true it is. And thank you so much for joining me on this journey. I'm sure there will be many comments and corrections that the Chassidim will have, and I welcome that. And have a happy Purim.